Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, a show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper. I am your host, Eddie Villanueva, and alongside me, as always, is my good friend and host with the most, Mr. Spencer Williams.
It's your boy.
Did not expect that. And talk about unexpectations. We also have with us Amy, intern Amy.
Yeah.
Unexpectations?
Unexpectations.
What does it even mean?
The expectations?
Of what?
Exactly, the opposite.
What?
It's opposite day.
Exactly. Apparently. We are celebrating the spooktacular month of Halloween, and we are capping this month off with a special review of a film that is close to my heart and a first-time view for these two, and that is 1982's Poltergeist. So stick around as we dive into that movie, get into the nitty-gritty, the curses of the film, and all the subtle things that went on behind the scenes, and we're going to have some fun. So, but before we do any of that, Spencer, why don't you give us the opening credits?
Coming. I don't know if you can say have some fun with some of that.
We are going to have some fun.
The
one time Spencer does the notes, and now he's...
because now I know the horrible truth. But anyway, you can also know the truth if you tune in to brand new episodes each and every week.
For real.
Yeah, on all our favorite streaming platforms and over on our website at filmlosophers.podcast.com. Also, connect with us on social pages at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter and Instagram at filmlosophy101.
Hey!
Threads, we're on there. And
Threads,
also Blue
something,
Sky.
Something,
one
Blue
day,
Sky.
One day, someone will fill me in on what we actually have to handle.
That's right. We got a website, filmlosophospodcast.com. There we got allegedly over 300 episodes, everything from action, anime, comedy, spooks, and wonderful things. Head on over to our website to check out all of those episodes at filmlosophospodcast.com. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audio Boom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music, everywhere else there's streaming podcasts, we're probably there. Look for us there. Look for us at The Filmlosophers. Give us a follow, subscribe, and listen in, and let us know what you think. It's true. We are going to be doing a spooktacular episode this week as we're going to be diving in to a cult classic and actually just an all-time great in the horror genre of 1982's Poltergeist. But we do have a special treat for you, and that is the reemergence, if you will, the come out of hibernation, the dusting off the old boots to get back into the ring after so many years. We are talking about the reemergence of the Jane Unseen segment.
Hey, that was not my fault.
It was your fault.
I've been unseen.
We've been wondering about that Steel Magnolias review for a long time.
I've never watched the movie. I'll never know.
Sad. It will make anybody sad.
He's like, well, I'll never know sadness.
You don't want to know this sadness. No, I'm not talking about Steel Magnolias as my unseen, so you're going to have to wait on that one. I'm sorry, Spence.
It'll be a weird choice for the spooky one.
It'll be a whole another year. It's like, yeah, sadness. It's sadness. Spooky because it's real life.
No, but for
now
this unseen.
I made myself sad.
See? And he knows. But besides unseen Poltergeist, which we'll talk about later, I actually took the opportunity last week to tease that I have unseen 1996 Scream. Yes, I have avoided it like the plague, but still the ending was spoiled for me. So this one, I actually kind of went in with some understanding of like the expectations, which kind of jaded me. But of course, this slasher film was directed by Wes Craven, and it stars David Arquette, Neve Campbell, Courtney Cox, Matthew Lillard, who I love, Rose McGowan, Skeet. I can never pronounce Skeet's last name.
Here's the funny thing. Right before we went on the air, I literally said, Amy, you need to make sure you have all the names correct.
The man's name is Skeet.
You need to make sure that you know exactly each character and each cast member. And you're like, I know, I can do this.
I did. But Skeet Ulrich is a weird one because his name is Skeet, not Skeeter.
Wait, I'm sorry. What's his last name?
Ulrich.
Ulrich.
Yes. Ulrich.
You said Ulrich earlier.
Yeah, I know. Andrew Barrymore. So, you know, if you have not seen this movie, it's 28 years old. I don't know where you've been. Probably like me, trying to avoid it if you don't like horror movies. But surprisingly, this was actually a real nice delight to watch. It is set in a fictitious town in California, where Sidney Prescott, Nev Campbell's character, is essentially being stalked by a killer. But it starts off very prominently with Drew Barrymore. Oh, and it also has Jamie Kennedy in it. Why did I forget Jamie Kennedy?
Because you forget the important people. We all know it's okay.
I mean, he's not even like when you go to the wiki, he's not at the top.
Henry Winkler's in this as well.
Yeah, I mean, Henry Winkler is in this. Anyway, so the movie starts off with a bang, especially with Drew Barrymore. And I was pleasantly surprised at the lacking amount of gore. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. In this, but
the
still,
lack of gore or yes. the amount of.
No, the lack of
yeah,
gore.
Yeah, the lack of gore, yeah.
And how it was actually very well kind of tailored to meet.
Almost as if everybody who's been saying this is a good movie for her to watch has actually been right.
I don't do spooky movies. Yeah. I had a problem after I watched Halloween and understanding that I really don't like house horror as well as
Now, really quick,
horror.
Before you get into the details of this, from your research, why is Wes Craven so notable?
Because he did Hellraiser.
Okay. I just realized that this is not going to... He did not do Hellraiser. That was Clive Barker. Clive Barker is a whole nother beast. This is all staying in the episode, too, by the way.
Well, I'm glad he's responsible for Nightmare on Elm Street, but also...
Among other things.
But we had also had the conversation when I had told you that I had watched Scream, that this was actually kind of his... Wes Craven had become exhausted with the horror genre. People had said that he was kind of like... He was losing his touch, and he did this kind of, I'm not going to say to give the middle finger, but he played into the tropes of horror. And after having a conversation with you, it really revitalized and brought more interest back to the horror genre for a new entire generation of people who were just tired of the same old slashers. Did I miss anything?
Well, I mean, so Wes Craven got his big break in the 70s with Last House on the Left. And ever since that one, it was just, there were films that he did obviously after the fact that weren't as impactful because The Last House on the Left was really something to behold. So yeah, there is truth in what you're mentioning. The fact that Wes Craven went from creating one of the most iconic slashers of the 80s horror genre to almost wanting to give up on creating films in that whole aesthetic ever is really kind of crazy to me, because it's like, how does somebody as iconic as Wes Craven go from like creating, you know, gold with Robert Englund to, I don't want to do this anymore, you know? So,
well, and that was kind of something that was really interesting in watching this while the story progresses. It is he was really concerned about making sure that the gore was tightened or the violence was tightened down so that he could get that R rating that he was looking for, which surprisingly, when you look at it as a whole, by today's standards of some of the horror that I've seen slash experienced, this is very tame. But with that being said, it is not lacking at all in the kills. It's not lacking at all in the performances from everybody. Even if you know what the end is and who the killer is, it is such a delight to watch, especially considering that, this is going to sound so funny, the last thing I saw Rose McGowan in was the Grindhouse, the Grindhouse feature, which was not, I almost said Death Race, and that's not it. What is it?
You mean, you're talking
where
about
she's Cherry
Planet
and
Terror.
Yeah, she's got the machine gun on her leg.
It's the Robert Rodriguez, Quentin Tarantino Presents Grindhouse thing.
But it was, in seeing her in this, and then also with Nev Campbell, it was such a delight. And I've always had the really ridiculous fun fact about, I had known Matthew Lillard from Hackers, which we brought up.
Hack the planet!
The year before. And then in seeing this, it was really great. I don't know if anybody's seen it, and I really like, if there's somebody that maybe is listening and hasn't seen it, I don't want to spoil it, but I was so pleasantly surprised, and I don't know if I want to see Scream 2 now, just in case it's not as delightful as this was.
Yeah, it's they're all interesting, and then it kind of goes meta with Scream 5, as we saw.
There was a lot of meta in this one too, where you have Jamie Kennedy, who gives you the rules of horror, which was such a great, like, we got the rules of Halloween with Trick or Treat, and you get the rules of horror from this movie, which was very, very fun. And then the tongue-in-cheek nature of Jamie Kennedy is literally sitting on the couch watching Halloween, yelling at the TV, Jamie, turn around. Jamie's right behind you. Jamie, turn around. There's the killer right behind him. And I was like, wow, how many walls are you breaking right now, friend? How many?
Well, if it's any consolation, Wes Craven did every single one of them up to four. He didn't do five because he passed away.
So in other words, I can watch them with ease knowing that he's still at the helm.
Yeah, that he's still the mindset behind the intention for what these films are all about is pretty clear between one through four. Yeah. And the good thing is five doesn't deviate too hard from the original formula. However, it is slightly different. Yeah, it's just something to kind of engage in. But
if you want to watch iconic slashers and you're a scaredy cat like me, definitely check out Scream, because it surprises you in a nice way that doesn't come at you with a chainsaw. Yeah.
Did you have like a favorite moment in the movie?
I have a couple. The first one was Wes Craven in the hallway in the wig and the hat and the sweater for Freddy. It was just so left field. Like, the cutaway was perfectly timed. It was just so dorky and so hilarious.
Henry Winkler comes out. Sorry, Fred. Or not you, Fred.
Yeah. And he's like, what? And it's this weird comedic cut that is so hilarious. Right at the end with the telephone and the killer getting hit in the head with the killer, that was turned out to be a blooper. That was hilarious. And then I'm going to honestly say David Arquette and Courtney Cox flirting, like the chemistry is actually there where they're flirty. And they're like, oh yeah, we're supposed to be flirting as characters. I'm like, no, you guys are flirting. It's so cute. So yeah.
Leave it to Amy to pull out that one out of the first.
What? Did you want me to say Drew Barrymore being like, I'm making Jiffy Pop and getting a question wrong that I got right? So I was really proud of myself for that. But good. Yeah. Go me.
Well, there you go. If you want to catch more of Amy's Jane on Scene, head on over to our Instagram page where we post all of her interesting comments and reviews.
Or just listen to the episodes, because they mostly live on there. You can't really find them on the Instagram all the time.
That's or we'll give you the social links at the end of the episode. But that does transition us.
Way to plug your own.
Right? Hey. Trying to give her a little bit more.
It's like, go to this website. And you're like, nah.
No. I'm like, nah, you know what you do? This. Listen to the podcast, experience it firsthand, and then comment on the Instagram page and be like, hey, why should not put this one up?
Well, speaking of confusing instructions, that does bring us to our conversation of the evening, and that is our spooky review of 1982's Poltergeist. Again, this film has been a cult classic, as well as just a iconic film of the horror genre for decades, and it was about high time that these two finally saw this film. And so we are going to take our time as we unveil the thoughts and opinions and interesting tidbits of this film between us three. But before we do, Spencer, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
A young family is visited by ghosts in their home. At first, the ghosts appear friendly, moving objects around the house to amusement of everyone. Then they turn nasty and start to terrorize the family before kidnapping the youngest daughter.
Directed by Toby Hooper and written by Steven Spielberg, Michael Grace, and Mark Victor, the film stars Jo Beth Heather O'Rourke, Craig T. Nelson, Dominique Dunn, and Oliver Robbins. A couple key pieces about the film. Both of the terrors that plague Robbie in this film came from Steven Spielberg's own fears as a child, a fear of clowns and a tree outside his window. Yeah, talk about unique fears. On October 30th, sadly, in 1982, Dominic Dunn, the actress who played Dana in the film, Dominic Dunn's ex-boyfriend, strangled her unconscious in the driveway of her West Hollywood home. She died on November 4th, having never regained consciousness at the age of 22. Heather O'Rourke died of intestinal stenosis on February 1st, 1988, at the age of 12. Both are buried at Westwood Memorial Park in Los Angeles. If you don't know, Heather O'Rourke is the child who played Carol Ann, the main child. Last piece of information, Drew Barrymore was considered for the role of Carol Ann, but producer Steven Spielberg wanted someone more angelic. Barrymore's audition ultimately landed her the part of Gertie in E.T. the Extraterrestrial in 1982 of that same year. So, it is quite easily one of the most quote unquote cursed films of the 80s horror genre, and rightly so, as many things came about during the course of the filming of this movie, from noises and things happening on set to the unfortunate mishaps. Unfortunate is kind of the understatement, but the unfortunate events that followed during the course of either during, after, or before the release of this film with certain performers. So we're going to get into a lot of that, but of course, obviously, this movie is, what, 40?
Oh my gosh.
Let's see.
Math, I don't do it. I'm not paid to math.
It's about 42 years old. I'm not paid so if you math. Haven't seen it by now, this is your fair warning. Guys, here we go. Yes. Spoiler alert, you've been warned. So let's get into expectations. Obviously, I'm pretty sure both of you knew about the film,
yes,
or at least knew pretty much the little things that were going to come up that were probably linchpins to the whole story, whatnot. You guys pretty much knew about the whole film altogether.
No.
Mm-mm.
Oh, there were things that you guys were not aware
of. Most 100%. Of the film.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, high five.
So here's the first question then. From the perspective of somebody who has seen it and seen it just about every year since he's been alive, to you guys, like, coming into a movie like this that has been around for about 42 years, what was one of the biggest expectations you had when it came to watching an 80s horror film, or at least an 80s supernatural horror film? Let's start with Spencer.
Well, I guess I was coming in expecting, like, maybe, like, some dated scares, but, like, you know, still some, like, solid scares, that especially the way people go off about this specific movie. So I thought that, you know, there'd be something that really just stuck with people for it to, like, carry the momentum it has.
Okay. What about you, Ames?
Expectation for 80s supernatural horror, as well as it's coming from Steven Spielberg, practical effects of the yin yang, things that I can't understand, things that I would remember. But there was going to be scares that I wasn't expecting hokey scares. I was expecting things that tapped into that kind of prime area of the unexplained when we were still in kind of like that, I don't know what's going on. So apprehension's always been there, but this time it's heightened now because it was required watching.
Okay. So, cause I can't really do expectations, and I really don't remember the expectations I had when I was like 4 or 5.
Four or five.
I've seen this movie. Like,
what
I remember
the heck?
What this movie's from 1982.
Yeah.
I don't know what that sound was. Did you want to rephrase your question?
No.
Into a question.
No, that's exactly. It's that 4 or 5 thing. You're like, oh, I watched this when I was 4 or 5.
That's not
surprising. Carol Ann is 5.
We would go to my grandparents and they would put on Child's Play just to keep the kids entertained.
Yeah.
Yep. I know nothing.
I can say, though, coming into rewatching this film, one of the things that I just really looked forward to is, when it comes to Steven Spielberg, there is still a sense of, like, and I don't know if this translates well, but there's always a sense of, like, cinema when he does a movie. Whether if it's E.T., whether if it's Jurassic Park, whether if it's, like, Saving Private Ryan or whatever else not. Like, Steven Spielberg creates the epitome of what it means to go to the movies. Like, I watch this movie and it just fills the air. Like, and it's not even just a sound, but it's more so of just a feeling. Like, the whole sentiment of the entire movie just fills the room with, I guess, the feeling of being a kid back in the movie theaters, you know. So when I was, we were planning to rewatch this film, I have to say I was excited because I remember a lot of the feelings that I get when I see those types of movies, when I see his types of movies. So even if it's a scary movie, even if it's this movie, I know he's not the director, but I know he has a hand in it and I know he's a part of the storytelling of it. And then obviously knowing that Tobe Hooper is behind this, if you're not familiar with Tobe Hooper's work, he's more notable for a wonderful film he did during the 70s called The Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Hence why I mentioned chainsaws earlier. Keep going.
Okay. So, yeah, you know, you never know what you're going to get with a pairing like this. Both of them, incredible creatives, incredible directors, incredible writers. So knowing that these two were going to be working together, it just always is kind of this mindset of like what kind of magic is going to bring, you know, be brought out of them. So jumping forward to your first impressions, as soon as the film was over and the credits rolled, what were your first impressions? Let's start with Amy because she's probably going to say a lot.
No, I'm going to try not to say a lot because I want to actually have the conversation. I'm glad that I've watched it. Mm-hmm. I'm glad that it's over. Mm-hmm. It ended in such an 80s way and it's just there. I'm holding the rest of my comment for later in the episode. Spencer?
So, this movie has two trains for me.
Oh,
there's
boy.
The horror of the ghosts, and then there's the horror of living in the 80s. I was not expecting that to be a real contender for the horror in this, because like from just the whole, you know, catcalling of a child to...
Oh, my God.
I had to rewind the movie at that part to be like, what the heck just happened? I'm so sorry.
They literally saw her come out of the house. Like, I'm like, come on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, yeah. Real surprising, this movie. That's how I felt about it.
There you go. Well, diving right in, let's go ahead and talk about some of the story elements of this film. Obviously, this type of story really does revolve around something unique that not many people talked about during this era. It was always either a ghost story or zombies or things like that. And then you had Tobe Hooper and Steven Spielberg who decided to want to get more specific. They wanted to graduate, if you will, the level of what a haunted house was to something that not many people had seen before. Mm-hmm. And probably using a word that not many people had even heard before with the word poltergeist. And they created something that really stood out. Pertaining to the story, you are 100% correct on the sentiment of this film. It is very 80s. From the mentality of some of the men in this film to the housing market that is apparently so easy to get into during that time that nowadays like people can barely afford anything. It kind of aggravated me to the point where it's like, this is the reason why. It's movies like this that make millennials upset that we can't, and then boomers get wonder why we have a chip on our shoulder. It's like, I'm just saying.
Well, clearly the answer is to buy
a time machine. Yes.
No, buy a house that's built on top of a graveyard.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, like, that's exactly what you do. There were parts of it where I looked at it, and, like, one of the initial shots, like, after that first, like, minute and some change, which I'm not going to lie, the open just got you by, like, you're like, what's happening? But the overhead shot of, like, beautiful suburban, you know, America, blah, blah, blah. It's like, why does this look like more packed in like E.T.? Like it reminded me of that vibe. Mm. But it was kind of like the what's actually happening behind closed doors in perfect suburban America. And I was like, bad things. Bad things apparently are happening in the 80s in perfect suburban America.
There you go. The Craig T. Nelson, I think, would have, side note, I think Craig T. Nelson would have made a great just real estate agent. I would have bought a house from him. I'm just saying. He was selling me. I'm like, you know, I wouldn't mind living in the same neighborhood as Craig T. Nelson. You know, I just...
This is, and side note on that, in juxtaposition, I just rewatched The Proposal today and I forgot he was the dad in The Proposal. And I was like, oh, there's another dad right there. Now, this movie was so unexpected in the way that it kind of hit all the notes, not just about like the 80s, but I definitely want to like kind of jump in on those performances, because there is no way that you can get through this. Like, I don't know. I am still kind of really, really uncomfortable with Heather O'Rourke as Carol Ann. Like, angelic is an understatement, but I was just my girl.
What? I'm
like, no. So when we first meet her in that literal first minute and a half in the thing, she kind of throws you off by she comes and sits down at the TV and she's like, louder, I can't hear you. And I'm like, where are you? Where do we end up in? What's happening? Like, I'm thinking it's one of those flash forward flashbacks type of things. Mm-hmm. And it's not. It's just there and happening. And then when everything goes down and she gets sucked in and then you're just kind of hearing her, I'm like, no. No, baby. No. No. No, 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 no. Mm-mm.
Yeah, the thing about Heather is, like, I feel like at the beginning she was like demon possessed. Like, I thought that was gonna come up at some point.
It felt like there. I know they bring it up where whoever came in first and was like, "Oh yeah, you had a child that was born in the house." Like, "Oh yeah, it's Carol Ann." I'm like, so she's possessed.
Yeah.
She got to be possessed.
I know. I was like, we have to get that ghost out of your daughter. That's why they're so interested.
Oh my gosh. Aside from the Carol Ann character, you also have two other children in Robbie, who is the 10-year-old, and then Dana, I believe, who plays a 16-year-old?
Yeah, Dominique Dunn is Dana Freeling, and I can honestly... This is something I struggled with. While her performance is there, she acts like, you know, typical 16-year-old teenager.
Like, careful what you say of the dead.
We don't really
just
see...
Saying.
We don't really see her having as much interaction as a whole, as like a child in that house, as having that that innate connection not only to the house and to what's happening within it, or like she's in that weird space of she's kind of a teen, she's almost an adult but she's not an adult, but the house is just kind of like, whatever girl, like you're over there. And that I think was really frustrating to me, because she didn't lack in performance. Like, when
it could also have been that they were planning to use her for a bigger role in a future film, and that didn't pan out, obviously. You don't know the circumstances they're in. I mean, I don't,
but I also, like, in seeing her interact with Robbie at the breakfast table and, like, everything else that was going on with that, I was like, oh, so she's, like, the protective older sister. Like, that's the kind of brain I was going with, where we've seen other older siblings in other 80s movies who are kind of like, these are my siblings, like, back off. Mm-hmm. And we didn't really get that from her. So I feel it was kind of an underutilization of her as a character.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like also, like, they were trying to, like, you know, she's like becoming her own person. So she's off doing other things. But I'm also like, girl, your sister got by a ghost. Like, what are you doing? Like, why are you out? Like, she's just fits into a weird space, you know? Yeah. So it's a bit odd. That's all I'll say.
Yeah, I mean, I can understand also the part of, like, the trauma at the house, trying to flee from it, to get away from it. So I fully understood that. But there was also, like, why help? Just help, just a little extra. Like, I know you're scared, you can do it, but if we want to bring up, like, somebody who I know you can do it, Oliver Robbins as Robbie, like, again, he's swinging from the fences in all areas of this movie. Like, oof. Yeah.
he was a really good actor, and his efforts in not only from the get-go almost being eaten by a tree to being kind of the if you will, surrogate both middle and younger child for the role, for the majority of the film, because Carol Ann isn't in it.
Yeah.
You know, it's pretty instrumental, because before we get to the point where Carol Ann is gone, there's a dynamic of the older sibling, the middle sibling, and the younger sibling. And it's very apparent, especially at that breakfast table. And then with the removal of Carol Ann, Robbie has to play both middle child and younger sibling to fill in kind of the gaps, almost as if he takes on the mantle himself just to carry that for the sake of his family. And it's very interesting. There are a lot of thoughts and suggestions about Robbie's character and kind of the things that he gets wrapped up in during the course of the film. But if we have time, we'll dive into those as well.
Yeah. And for Oliver, I think he didn't just play like wide-eyed, I'm in trouble kid. He actually had like a lot of continuing depth in his performances, where when he's interacting with Jobeth, I can't remember your last name, Jobeth.
Williams.
Thank you.
Williams, yeah.
The mom. Yeah. It felt really familial. Like there wasn't a disconnect. Like that was actually her kid. And he goes from like the very beginning, and I remember yelling at the screen. They go to bed and he's freaking out about the tree outside the window. And I had figured out what type of tree it was too. So I was just like, can't you just close his boy's blinds? Like close his curtains, let the homie sleep. Like just.
Well, the ghost did after it took him.
It's true. he's got a point.
Yeah, you do.
And then on top of that, from the children to the parents, I mean, obviously you have the dynamic between Craig T. Nelson and Jobeth Williams as the parents, respectively, the father and mother. I don't know about you guys. I don't know if you ever saw the show Coach.
Mm, yep. That's exactly as soon as it came out. I was like, it's Coach.
Yeah. with Craig T. Nelson playing the father role in this one, and then at the time, having the experience of seeing him in that show, it was really interesting. From the last time I saw him in a film, because I think the last time I saw him in a movie, it may have been a rewatch of Blaze of Glory with Will Ferrell and John Heder.
That's right. He's the coach in that one, too.
He's got the market cornered on coaches.
I thought you were going to bring up the fact that he's Mr. Incredible.
Well, that's not the last time I saw him in anything.
I mean, physically saw him.
No, that was the last time.
Oh, he's acting.
Right? He's also the father in The Family Stone. So, but to see where he is now or as of late versus where he was then, it's like, man, he was fit. He had a good structure on him going there, you know, especially when he was doing like the sucking in and sucking out of his gut, and then
the diving sequence was so he's like, you could dive, and he was doing just the weird things at the end of the bed, like jumping around, and you're like, you guys are weird, I like you.
I mean, it's weird for the sake of like, for it being the 80s, you have Reaganomics happening during this time. You have an obvious like mention or actual correlation to the Reagan era of things with Craig T. Nelson's character reading a book about Reagan.
Yeah, it's called like the Reagan Machine or something like that.
Reagan the Man, Reagan the President or something like that. Mm-hmm. All the while he's reading that, Jobeth Williams is rolling a joint.
Which he passed her. He's like, here, do you roll this next one? And I'm just like, okay, that's where we're at, people.
But it's such a juxtaposition on like the kind of societal implications that that means. Like anybody who knows Reagan's impact during that era knows that like Reagan did this whole war on drugs campaign. And so he was anti just about everything you could think was a drug. And at the same time, while he's reading that book, his wife is rolling a joint. So yeah.
And actively participating.
Yeah.
Which we're like, that's illegal at your time. Like, we know it is. You don't have to play.
Yeah. So yeah, as the film progresses, you have Jo Beth Williams. Or, so obviously Carol Ann makes contact with this otherworldly entity through the television. We get the iconic "they're here" scene.
Which was the only, to be very honest, if we're talking about expectations, that was the only thing I knew from Poltergeist. That was it.
Same.
I knew static TV. I knew a little kid sitting in front of it, the poster, and her going, "they're here." I knew nothing else.
Yeah.
Yep.
It is an iconic scene. Like, it is one of those things where it's been used and satired and parodied and whatnot so much that it is kind of lived in infamy. It's kind of like the "here's Johnny" from The Shining. Mm. It's been done over and over and over and over again. But it is iconic, and I don't know if I don't know if that scene would have been as famous or as quotable if it was Drew Barrymore who had done that.
No offense to Drew Barrymore. Let's be very honest. That is not the problem.
I didn't know there was a problem.
I don't know. The fact that she got Gert in E.T. was like, I loved her in that. But also if she was in this and then she had been in E.T., like, I don't know. But I don't think this was ever... You can see why Heather O'Rourke was cast, like, hyper-specifically.
Mm-hmm. There's a sense of innocence that, like, Heather O'Rourke carried in this film that obviously she was a lot smarter than what she made herself out to be in the film. Mm-hmm. For the sake of her role, but she carried that, like, innocence and that almost kind of, you know, purity, if you will, as, like, you know, a child only can in this role. Like, it was like the epitome of what child's innocence looks like. And she played it very, very well. And then you had the situation. So obviously after that, things start to happen. And Jo Beth Williams, as well as Carol Ann, start to notice and recognize that things are happening in the kitchen. And
they're playing with it at that point. Like, they're like, oh, the chairs. And then she puts her in the circle of the helmet. It's like, slide the kid.
I cannot imagine doing the same thing. Like, I don't know if she just lives in a world without horror movies or what. But, like, the second things start sliding around on the ground and I'm like, there's no scientific explanation for this, I'm out of the house. I'm selling that house. I will never step foot again in that house.
See, and you're the logic of that, because I could see how Dana was like, oh, it's something fun. Like, she's the person. I think they tried to establish that early on in that sequence with them in the bedroom where she's the one that's smoking and he's the one that's reading the Reagan book, that she's more, air quotes, open-minded to experiences versus seeing the harm in them. And he's like the, I'm the man's man. I gotta be this way. But literally, I'm with you. As soon as those chairs stacked on top of the table and they were all every which way, no. I'd have been like, okay, so it's time for us to go visit Grandma. Mm-hmm. And we will be back in a couple of days.
We will not be back, actually. Just so you all know.
We'll be back to pack.
We'll buy you new stuff. It's fine. No, it's dead to me. The whole everything. The second we leave, everything's dead.
Burned to the ground.
We left the dog. It's dead. Ebuzz was so nice.
He was
a very cute dog. Very good at being on the spot.
And it's funny because that whole premise, going back to the mom, to Jo Beth Williams and Carol Ann, Heather O'Rourke's character playing, or at least her forcing Carol Ann to sit in that circle and do the little thing with the whatever entity is doing it. It was very reminiscent, if you will, of, I don't know if you guys ever heard of a series. It was a mini series at first called The Tommyknockers.
Yes.
It was on television. I'm trying to find the year on it, but I don't know.
Why does it sound like it was the movie? It was,
wasn't that the one where, like, they were on a plane and, like, they had flown through something?
That's the Langoliers.
Ah.
So the Tommyknockers was from 1993. What's his name? The guy who played...
He played a thing?
He did play a thing at one point in time. Mm. Jimmy Smits was in it.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So, ultimately... the Tommyknockers is essentially about a crashed alien ship that breaks on impact, like crumbles, like it's destroyed on impact in this small town, and these local townspeople, they find pieces of the ship, and they realize that the pieces of the ship have power, and they can do stuff with that if they utilize it or figure out a way to harness it.
Oh,
and
no.
So everybody's learned, either everybody's using it for technology or some people are using it for like knowledge. And there's this one scene in the miniseries, and I thought it was the most funniest thing, but it's like, it's also scary because it reminds me of like the misuse of the unknown.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a boy who is, he's essentially trying to be a magician. And so he uses a piece of the spaceship, and he fastens it to a one of those sewing,
the pedal,
yeah, to a sewing machine with a pedal, and he realizes that if he uses it and he spins
pedals,
it,
by the way, my sewing machine still has a pedal.
Well, no, it's one that he has to constantly, not well, just automatic.
You have to press it. So the pedal pedals. Mine's well, just no, you have it's to keep pressing
only,
down the it, pedal.
It's only
so
one
that it
pedal, but it. It may, it's either way, it's on a wheel. So it's on a flywheel.
Pedal
either way.
Wheel.
So
wheel that pedal.
So he's figured out that if he adds the spaceship piece to the sewing machine thing, he can actually put things on the table part and put a sheet over it. And if he pushes the pedal, he can make it disappear.
That's fun.
If he pushes it back, the thing will reappear. And so he decides that he's going to do this at a kid's birthday party. And mind you, he's only like 10, 11, or maybe 12 at the time. And so he does it with like some stuff or whatever. And then he decides to do a human volunteer.
I knew that was going to happen.
And this little boy, and I believe it's like this younger brother of the magician, of the kid. And he puts him on the thing, and he does the pedal thing, and he disappears, and he's not able to bring him back. And I'm like, that's what you get. That's what you get. Like you mess with the fire, you're going to get burned. Like that's what this scene always reminded me of. It's like even Carol Ann's like, that hurt. It's like, yeah, you're having her mess with things.
Butt stings. It's like,
it's like radiation. It's like, oh, you know, oh, it makes me feel funny. Yeah. Cause it's going to start making you lose your hair shortly. You know, it's like you're letting your kid, you're forcing your child to be in this position where they're being exposed to this thing. That could have been, what if that was it? Just conspiracy theory thought. What if that was the reason why Carol Ann was the one who got taken?
I thought initially that was going to be the reason.
Like, because of the fact that she's got, like, way too much, like, butt sliding on.
They were literally like, listen, we are tired of sliding this kid's butt. We're just going to take her.
We're just going to hold on to her for a while.
Like, maybe. I mean, I think the bigger thing for why they took Carol Ann first off is she was the one that could hear them. Which, when I could start hearing them through the static, I was like, oh, no. I don't want to hear them anymore. but then also, like, the fact that when they cop to, like, oh, surprise, she was born in the house. I was like, well, that's your problem right there.
Why did you sound almost like Wisconsin? Like, well, that's your problem right there. I'm
trying to fit in, just tell them what the problem is so they right. leave.
Maybe that's the goal.
So obviously we get this long and really weird way of Joe Beth Williams explaining it to Craig T. Nelson about what's going on. They really don't know how to explain it. And then ultimately the situation happens where Carol Ann gets sucked into the closet. Oh, on the same evening that Robbie ends up getting abducted out of his bed by the ominous tree and almost eaten.
Okay. And with the mini tornado as well.
Well, we also need to establish. So
it was the March of the Ents.
It was
they
a
were
distraction
ready to,
campaign.
They thought it was Saruman's castle, okay? They were trying to get Saruman. Let's just be honest.
No, so I want to bring up this tree because as soon as I saw this tree.
Nobody's on my side.
Sorry.
No, nobody is. But when I saw this tree and initially started climbing it, because everything seems hunky-dory at the beginning, you know, after that first sequence. And then it's like, oh, it's a regular day and everybody's playing outside and kids are being kids and people are watching TV, whatever. And he's climbing the tree. And I could see from the knots, they looked like faces. And I went, oh, it's an yew tree. Okay, there's a graveyard in their house.
So why don't you, since you're doing the gatekeeping thing again, why don't you explain what a yew tree is?
So a yew tree, Y-E-W, is a tree that is usually planted on the outskirts of cemeteries, and they usually predate where the cemeteries are. A lot of churches are built around them as well. The concept of the yew tree, or the symbolism of the yew tree, is one of protection for particular people, but it also represents, yeah,
literally. Did not work.
Yeah. As soon as the tree went up, it was off. But it also represents life, death, and rebirth. And then it actually kind of feeds on all the decomposing bodies inside of the cemetery. That's how it sucks it up through its soil, and it gets really big and huge. And then, fun weird fact that I just found out today when I was researching yew trees, is it actually, when it starts dying off, it becomes hollow and it pushes out these bulges that look like faces, which is super creepy. And then when it officially dies, another one literally just sprouts straight out of the middle of it and like breaks it in half.
Huh.
Yeah. Also, fun fact, it's a wand of somebody in Harry Potter. Mm. So yeah.
Again, are you going to keep gatekeeping, or are you going to tell us who that is?
No. Why don't you?
Because you're the one who's gatekeeping this information.
I am not.
So then who is it? Oh, you don't know. Yes, that's why.
That's
okay.
The real bro.
That's
I clocked out too.
Wow. Well, that's why you don't give information you're not fully sure on yet.
No, I couldn't remember.
Uh-huh. And watch it's nobody. Like, nobody has this.
Oh, I feel like someone did.
No, because it's the white wand, so it's Lord Voldemort's wand. I double checked. It's not the Elder Wand. It's the weird white one with the speckly handle.
Uh-huh. So, obviously, it's a traumatic experience for little Robbie as he almost gets gobbled up by a flesh-eating tree. And at the same time, his and Carol Ann's closet turns into a Hoover vacuum and sucks little Carol Ann down the spiritual gullet of the house.
It didn't take the clown doll, but it took Carol Ann. I was so mad at that. It was like, take the doll.
It needed its best soldiers on the front, okay?
No! I'm not here for that.
So ultimately, this ends up skipping over to the dad, Craig T. Nelson's character, asking help from paranormal researchers, which, interestingly enough, I don't know if paranormal research had been such a big thing at that point in time, educationally wise, like taken seriously as an actual science. I know we had, when was Ghostbusters made?
I want to say 84.
Was it 84? Well, and then I know prior to that, you had the many, many tales and researchings.
84,
okay. Prior to 1982, you had the many, many tales and researches. The research from Ed and Lorraine Warren, famous paranormal researchers who actually have become more famous because of the Conjuring franchise, which is based on their happenings. So, James, are you familiar with the Conjuring, Spencer?
I'm looking at you. Of a movie, but like I had no idea who you're talking about.
So the movie is based on the the true tellings of Ed and Lorraine Warren, who are famous paranormal researchers who I believe Ed passed not too long ago, and I think Lorraine might still be alive. I could be wrong. But they're the ones who researched a lot of the more infamous hauntings like the Amityville and things like the Annabelle doll, which is an actual thing. They've done plenty of research through some of the more bigger and well-known hauntings. So besides that, I don't know if like paranormal research has really been anything notable within the scientific community. Mm-hmm. So to have it, I find it just interesting that Craig T. Nelson goes to a college or a like place of education to seek help.
Well, you know, I mean, if we're looking at the options of the two, not only does Dana, right? Yeah, not Diane. I almost said Diane. Dana, she she partners and trusts that her husband is going to do the right
Dana,
thing.
No. Dana's the daughter.
I
You're talking about Diane?
Diane. Darn it. See, I got it backwards.
So, I was like, who are you talking
so
about?
So I said, I went to say Dana, and then I said Diane, and then I said, no, it's Dana. So with Diane, she trusts that Steve is going to do what's best for their family, that he's leading. And so considering that they've kind of also established him as a hesitant believer, that he is more logically sound and based, and he goes for somebody who is he needs somebody to prove it. Mm-hmm. And in going to the university and finding that team to come in, he's like, listen, like I need you to come help me. Like, he's not to the let's find a medium level of seeking help. He's the I need the science. I need someone to prove to me that I'm not crazy. They can see it too. They experience it too. I need your help. So I think that's kind of that line of logic that follows him as a character, which does really well in juxtaposition when we get later into the film and who they bring in to assist.
Having this kind of meet with them, they decide to go and visit the house. They do end up seeing everything that occurs. And obviously they are finding that it's true that there is a poltergeist of sorts happening at the residence. And so they take their research and they bring, ultimately come back with the bigger guns, i.e. What is her name? The medium.
Zelda Rubinstein. She's one of my favorite people. She's so, okay. So really quick, I want to gush about her. She is a shorter in stature person. And primarily in the 80s, you see her in really kind of random movies. She was in Teen Witch.
Teen Witch.
But she's also the organist in 16 Candles right at the end in her little weird hat. It makes me really happy. And she's got a voice that, like, when you hear her, you're like, I know your voice. I don't know you, but I know your voice. And yeah, so this was just a delight to see her come in as the actual support to fix the problem.
Well, and she was also, so she's also done, she did Poltergeist 3, and then I don't know, oh, and then she, oh, she did 2 and 3, I'm sorry. And then I don't think she carried on after that. She also did a fun role in Behind the Mask, The Rise of Leslie Vernon, which was released in 2006, which if you haven't seen that one, that's a great, absolute, beautiful homage to the slasher genre of the 80s. Just a little tidbit about that. It's ultimately about this TV news crew who is following kind of the makings of a slasher serial killer, watching how he does all of his workout routines, how he is able to, like, he's like, you ever notice how, like, whenever you see someone run and, you know, the killer always seems to be behind them, but they're not breathing heavy. It's like a lot of cardio. And it's just, it's really interesting. But throughout the entire film, he is met with like a ton of other well-known names that are ultimately quote unquote retired from the industry. Mm-hmm. And people like Kane Hodder, Nick Castle, Robert Englund. It's just, it's a who's who of like everybody who you'd want to see in a movie like this. So, but she's made a name for herself throughout the course of history. And, she appears in this film as Tangina, a, medium with very unique and special abilities. And through the course of her help and whatnot, they are able to pull Carol Ann through the other side into the realm of the real. And she ends up saying her iconic phrase, this house is clean.
She puts on her little aviator glasses. It was really funny. Spencer just shaking his head at me.
No, I'm shaking my head at her statement. It was not clean, as it turns out.
Truth.
It wasn't as clean as it could be.
Well, yeah. Whether if it's haunted houses or clean butts, it needs to be either 100% or not at all. So,
not at all. What?
Yeah.
Either one way or another, you can't get past it with a partially squeaky butt.
Exactly. And ultimately, that does lead to the infamous and wonderful scene that pretty much made Amy jump out of her seat. And that was the introduction to the wonderful clown that had been foreboding throughout the entire film.
I I knew it.
Chekhov's clown.
I kid you not. I saw that clown, and when Robbie's like, listen, I'm going to put my... He's literally seeing me like, the tree scares the crap out of me. And this clown is just like, sup, homie? And he's staring right at him in the mm-hmm. chair. And when he puts the first time he puts the jacket over, I'm like, he needs to be in the back of your closet, sweetie.
Mm-hmm.
Needs to stay in the back of your closet and never come out.
Because even the ghost dragged that clown to the back of the closet.
Right. And then when clown came back, no, Spencer.
Yeah, when that clown was missing, I was like, oh no.
I was like, buddy, this house ain't clean. As soon as mom was taking a bath, I'm like, we're all screwed.
I feel like I 100% misunderstood the conversation that Craig T. Nelson and her were having earlier, where I'm like, oh, like, we're leaving tonight, yes?
Yeah.
Like, I thought that was the plan. And like, if they get tired, you let them go to sleep. And I'm like, okay. In your bed, right? Because that's what I
would downstairs do. Or like in visible the driveway. Area,
somewhere I'm going to
have
be.
Them sleep on the lawn. I don't care. It's camp out night. Everyone's in a tent.
See, it should have been camp out
yes.
night. That was the whole thing. Like, everyone's going to. I did not get where it's like, hey, first off, Carol Ann got a brand new headboard that was the exact same one that got sucked into the closet. And I was like, girl, you had time to do this with everything else going on. This is what you invest your money in? Your Atlas moving van isn't getting gone fast enough.
I know.
And then they're like, it's okay. And and then the blinds were closed and the curtains were pulled in that room when Robbie went to sleep, but the clown was still there. And I was like, this is how you set me up for hard no-nos, y'all. You're like, I'm like, oh, is this how we hide that the tree got sucked up into the black tornado and disappeared? So, you know, everything's hunky-dory, air quotes. No. No, you have that entire sequence. No,
like, honestly, the part that I found just baffling on the parents' part of this is that they let the children stay in the abduction room.
Yeah, like it was
that was the room with mm-hmm. the suction,
and they closed the door.
Yeah,
wild. That was the other,
absolutely mm-mm. wild, and exactly the type of thing I expect from 80s parents to be perfect.
I was going
to
say, exactly.
I can see that, yeah.
The medium said it was fine. They're fine.
And so this is kind of the pivotal moment where obviously the event starts happening again. A huge Ghostbuster-esque, you know, hole in the closet forms, quite literally turning into the spiritual and physical gullet of the house, and begins to suck in everything in that room again.
Now with that tendril tongue.
Yes. And then all the while, the mom is being bogarted from the room by whatever spirits with electricity and, you know, whatnot. She ends up falling down the stairs and then blasted from the door. And she's ultimately kept from going anywhere.
And then she goes back. She fights her way upstairs. She gets into the door.
That's not before she ends up into the pool trying to get help.
Hole. Oh, my gosh.
It was a hole. It wasn't even a pool.
Okay, like, the beginnings of whatever it was supposed to be.
The best part for me was, like, they had a pump to get out the water. And every single time she went out in that backyard, it was raining. And I'm like, girl, I don't know where you at. Like, I don't know where this is, but this is a hard.
I'm like, this might not be California because it don't rain that much.
This might not be the best place for you to be building a swimming pool, sweet pea.
And so we get the iconic scene where she falls into the pool, and while she's in there, skeletons begin to pop up, which we did. So there was a series on Shudder, the streaming service, not too long ago called Cursed Films, and they did a whole entire episode on this particular film. And they did talk in detail about, you know, the situations with Dominic Dunn and Heather O'Rourke and things like that, as well as a few other incidences that happened on the set. But they did mention this particular rumor, which had been floating around for a while, perpetuated by Joe Beth Williams's character, or the actress herself, saying that they put me in there with real, you know, bodies, blah, 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 blah.
I was about to ask.
So. So check this out. So in the documentary for Cursed Films, the special effects artist was on there, and they flat out asked him, like, did you use them? And he goes, look, it was the 80s.
Yes, that's
there were budget restraints. when you are used, when you essentially have a very thin budget and you need to skimp where you can, but you have expectations from the director and everyone else, you find where you can. And if you go to the local university or you go wherever, then you can get this. He said they were skeletons that we had. They were just skeletons. We added the extra stuff.
Just skeletons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, does that make you feel better that they were just skeletons?
Hey, you know, somebody's mom who died in the 50s got really famous that day, okay?
Just terrible. Absolutely terrible. And also, unsurprising.
One of them had to be a clown. One of them had to have been the body of a clown.
Obviously. Like, no, like, when I was reading, like, the things that happened to the other two, I was like, oh, something happened to everyone in this movie, and I wonder what it was for the people who survived.
Well, so I know, so talking about, so let's kind of jump into some of the information that's gone out there. So there were reports while on set that things did move around, that there were quote unquote some supernatural happenings. That could have also been due to the fact that a lot of people were probably getting high while on set. You know,
not in Reagan's America.
Of course not.
Whatever do you mean? Rampant drug use. What?
In Hollywood.
But honestly, a lot of it. So the funny thing, though, is that the only reason why a lot of the quote unquote cursed elements are attributed to this film is mainly because of Heather O'Rourke and Dominic Dunn. The film obviously had its hiccups just through the course of its production. You know, things move, things happen, blah, blah, blah. People make reports. The issue that happened with this film is that because of those deaths, the film automatically became labeled as cursed. And so because of that, the perpetuation of like, because the effects artist, he was like, look, we're not the first people to use these. We're not the first people to use like actual bones. Like, people have used bones like this before. We've had permission from, you know, the place where we got them from. You know, you buy them, you know. He goes, look, we used what we had available at the time, and it was not a very uncommon practice. And I think that's the key thing. It's like, it wasn't. So it makes you think, if you go back probably to like every unique film between the 70s and the 80s, how many of them used skeletons and how many of them were actually real skeletons?
Okay, but like, I would also point out, how many of those movies have a plot point where someone took a shortcut and didn't do a thing with dead bodies? Just like the props master is like, it's like, that's actually a good idea.
It's like, so we're gonna stuff these bones into this mud. How long let's leave them in there for the whole production. We only need them for the end. It's like, okay, that's not gonna mess with the mojo of the film, will it? Nah.
Yeah, we're gonna desecrate anything.
Wait, what's the premise of this film? Oh yeah. Who knows? Like, honestly, on the otherworldly level of everything that happened on this film, like, who knows what implications or like what buttons were pushed, whether corporally or non-corporally. But it does bring up a really good point about like, if this is the one that gets recognized for like using it because someone found out, quote unquote, found out, I wonder how many more have been used that were not found out.
Probably all of the movies from the
probably 80s. Every one of them.
The Goonies.
I mean, even Amy was mentioning the other day about the fact that there are Disney rides that used actual bones.
Yeah, I don't know if they've ever removed the last of them either.
God. Well, I think the skull and crossbone one is still real.
Yeah, the one that's at the headboard. So it's Pirates of the Caribbean. I'm not gatekeeping.
She's doing it again, but it's okay.
No, because you said it and I triggered it. But there's the headboard when you float past the captain, where it's like his chambers, and there's a harpsichord that's playing. There's skull and crossbones that are
on the
real
headboard.
That are on the headboard that are real. And there used to be
More.
There used to be a lot more. Fun other movie fact, that harpsichord that's playing is actually from The Ghost in Mr. Chicken, which was a Don Knotts movie that scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
Spencer, do you know who Don Knotts is?
Yes.
Okay, just checking.
Yeah.
Don Knotts. Get out of here with that.
Barney Fife.
Yes.
Exactly.
So yeah, I feel like there's an element to this film that could have been, if not cursed, it could have had some, I don't know, like what would you call it? Like karmic, you know, issues based on the fact that they used.
Don't use people's bones. Like, can we just not?
Can we just not? And all of this cultivating in a grand and very brightly lit climax towards the tail end, another climax. And the film ultimately ends with, as Amy had put it, a very 80s ending, as they end up at the hotel that they were intending to, but not before throwing the TV outside of the hotel room so that they didn't have a television in the room. So if ever there was a PSA on the dangers of TV, it was this movie in itself. So talking about the film, what were some of the things that you guys felt really stood out as, like, I guess, key takeaways with, because you think Steven Spielberg, you think Tobe Hooper, you gotta admit there's always an implication on some kind of American staple, whether if it's the economy, whether if it's the family dynamic, whether if it's the you know, price of capitalism, things like that. Like, what were some of the things that you guys took away? Let's start with Spencer, let's start with Amy, because Amy looks like she's ready.
No, I want Spencer to go, so I don't. Oh. So I don't take everything.
I mean, there's so many things in this movie, mm-hmm. from just the horror of living in the 80s. Again, I keep coming back to that. Like, it just seems like everyone had given up at that point. If we're willing to just, like, not do the work of removing graves because that's hard, and not giving people promotions because we don't want to, which, you know, feels like nothing's really changed, to be perfectly honest. Mm-hmm. And maybe that's really what the problem is that this movie is nothing changes and people are terrible.
Reaganomics year round. What about you, Ames?
No, I think that is the cost of capitalism. What is the cost of capitalism? And it only hits home, or it only matters when it personally hits home. When we look at the situation, you know, Steve Freeling had everything. He was like the top earner, and he had the brand new house, and he was the schmoozer, and he had the 2.5 beautiful children and the doting wife. He had it all. It was essentially the American dream, and he could not protect it. Like, mm-hmm. he had to succumb to the force of that he could not protect what mattered most to him at the end of the day. And when he finally got them back, instead of being like, hey, we're all leaving tonight, nobody's staying in the house, I gotta go talk to the boss, we're just gonna go to the Holiday Inn, have Dana meet us there when her boyfriend drops us off in his little slug bug.
Because she already knows where it is.
Yep. Maybe. Yeah. I don't know. But just instead of taking that route, he was still so set on being the man's man, holding everything in control. He failed to see that what his family ultimately needed was him as a protector there, protecting all of them.
Yeah.
Another big thing that was a takeaway for me, of course, was that this passed the Bechdel test, even though really the Bechdel test is a test for film and other medias where it's two named women who have a conversation and it's not about a man. It happens in two spaces in this movie, which is one where we have the doctor. What's her name?
Dr. Lesh.
Yes. Dr. Lesh talking to Diane about what's going on, and that solid maternal, without pushing too far into the line, kind of comfort that she mm-hmm. brings to her in the reminder of you're a mother. And, you know, even providing the guidance to Robbie that, you know, the difference between that there's some people that are mean and there's some people that are kind, and relaying that in relation to, like, spirits and what happened to his sister, and that it's okay.
Mm-hmm. Although, not to cut you off, but mm-hmm. it is unique to mention in that particular scene where you do see the dad awaken and almost seem as if he wants to interject, wants to add his own two cents to this conversation, this intimate conversation, mm-hmm. mind you, because it's two women who are in close proximity, they have dropped both of their, you know, their guards, and they're being very vulnerable and honest with each other. I mean, it even, it, Dr. Lesh, who is supposed to be the professional in this situation, is like, I'm terrified.
Yeah.
And it creates this openness for this conversation to be had. And you have the dad, and mind you, it's not meant to, I don't think Craig T. Nelson's character or the actor himself is meant to make it seem as so, but I feel like the cut and the way this film was portrayed, it seems as though he was on the cusp of wanting to say something, to add his own two cents to the conversation that is being had, going back to the whole control aspect.
Well, and then the other space that you see that this happens is when Zelda Rubinstein, what's her medium's name?
Tangina
is there, and she's telling Diane, you know, the mother's love, like, and she's explaining all this, and you can kind of see in the background, you see, you know, Steve's face is like the pure skepticism of him. Like, he wants to interject, but he gives enough space to his wife to let her have this type of a moment. And so it really kind of hedged in the space of it noticed and recognized the shortcomings of the father, but the literal life tether of the mother to maintain the children and the house. Like, she was the one that literally jumped through, spoilers, we said it already, jumped into the gullet when it wasn't a gullet, right. just yet, to go get Carol Ann. And she came out. And then when she's still there with the kids, she's there with the kids. It's not him and her or anything else. It's just her. And it's this overwhelming presence as a mother to not only fight for your children, but to keep them safe and keep the home fires burning, which is very, I'm not going to say it is in, I have to say it's in juxtaposition to E.T., where we have, you know, a single mom. And she's doing the same thing to fight for her family and protect them. But she's taking on the mantle of both father and mother versus in this we see Diane being the wholly maternal character. So mm-hmm. there's conversations about that. There's conversations about the danger of TV and, you know, consumerism. And what are you willing to sacrifice to have your perfect ideal space? And how we isolate ourselves in times of crisis instead of actively seeking help and looking for our neighbors and actually building those relationships without quarrel. Like, there's so much in this movie.
There is, yeah.
Sorry, Spencer.
No. Was there anything you wanted to follow up with, Spence, since Amy went on that whole...
No, I'm good.
He's like, no, she did
it. No, well. You did a great job.
It's interesting how, like, as we continue to grow in understanding the way cinema is to be read and understood, it's almost like as we have spent so much time with, like, Shakespeare and people have now begun to understand, like, the very subtleties of Shakespeare in, oh, he meant that as, like, a backhanded comment and he meant it like that. And when you put these two limericks together and whatnot, it actually creates the same timing, blah, blah, blah. Like, the more and more that we understand certain types of films, especially horror films, Amy, as we begin to delve more and more into being open to these things, we begin to see that there's a bigger story in there aside from just jump scares or clowns.
Clowns are scary. They're supposed to be like agents of mirth and light. And when
mirth?
Yes, mirth. I said mirth.
No, okay.
I heard so mirth.
I was just like, I thought you were like, agents of mirthy and grace.
wow. No, I used the term correctly. But they're supposed to be that. And when they're twisted, it totally just like, it messes with my head at like a small child level. Which again, thank you, Tim Curry. You done messed me up, boy. I can't help it. No clowns.
Him and his mirth.
No 80s clowns.
Yes.
No 80s clowns. Yeah.
I think it goes back to what's his name? What was the name of that clown serial killer? John Wayne Gacy. Yeah. So I think the clown thing goes a little bit further than that. But oh, you know.
I try to ignore that altogether too.
Eater of worlds.
That's Galactus, please. He's not a clown.
If you guys were to...
No.
Oh, really? If you guys were to break down like some, like at least one memorable part of this film, or one that you absolutely really loved about, part about this film, what would you guys say that would be?
Can I do a love and a hate? And I can start off with a hate.
Yeah.
Okay. So this is going to sound ridiculous.
The clown?
No, it's not going to be the clown.
So she liked the clown, Spencer. See?
No,
it's all good.
No. So this was kind of hysterically enough a trigger thing in watching it, and it dredged up some memories. So I grew up a military kid, and when we went on to the military base, whenever you watched a movie at the movie theater that was on the post, before it began, they would literally play the Star Spangled Banner, and you would stand up, and it would have all this, like, the jets flying overhead, and they play this video. And so I had never remembered experiencing a end-of-day broadcast.
Amy like never stayed up late watching TV, so.
No, like, that wasn't going to happen in my house. and so when that happened, for the first time that it happened when it was going off for the broadcast air, and it did that, I got so confused, and I had flashbacks to the movies that I saw.
She tried to stand up, Spencer. I had to sit her back down.
No, I was just like, I was really perplexed, and I turned and looked at you, and I was like, where are they? And you're like, it's end of a broadcast day. And for that moment, I simultaneously loved and hated that forever now I have never experienced the end of a broadcast day for a TV station.
Didn't they stop that in like the 70s?
I don't know. I have no idea. But I hated that I'm like, well, forever now all I'm going to remember is every time I hear that and they're showing all the pictures on the screen, I'm like, oh, it's time to stand up before we can watch the movie.
All the late night owls are just standing up.
And I hate it. They're just standing up at attention. And I was like, ugh, fine. Something I hate. Do you have something that you like and or hate about this movie, Spence?
I kind of liked really just the sense of wonder around the paranormal activity in this movie. I thought it actually came across really well even now, even though like I knew it's like kind of on the goofier side now, but I still thought it did like really good at like, you know, tension building, like you know something's about to happen, and just like the way they executed from that, like it kind of just had me like hooked on the movie, even though like this movie is all over the place with the 80s.
You're like, it felt it. If there's something that I liked, which I didn't think I, because we kind of touched on practical effects. There's one big-ish-er sequence that happens with a steak in the kitchen that translates into someone going into the bathroom. And there's a full practical face and everything that's going on. And I didn't think I was going to like it. But I had, since being forced to watch more scary movies, the practical effect work on when somebody's literally pulling a Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark and they're just scratching their face like, and it's falling apart in the mirror. I didn't think I was going to have as much appreciation until I realized in seeing other practical effects, how much work that takes to get that even to look semi-close to what the, like the person looked and the transition. And I was like, oh dang. Okay.
Yeah.
So that like overall the practical effects in this are so wonderful to see. And then like hearing about in relation to the practical effects, the work that had to go in to figuring out how to essentially suck people into the closet to make it look a certain way. And that I think it was LIM. Is it?
It was ILM. Yeah. Actually.
ILM. Yeah. They had to figure out a particular way to get the light to come out of the very first time before it turned into the giant, you know, gullet. But they had to figure out a way to have the light coming out for it to be in a certain way to throw everything into the closet to make it look like it was getting sucked in. And that if they messed it up, if there was a shadow, if something went wrong, they had to stop the entire take, reset everything, and then start over. Yeah. And I'm like, you people, I mean, dang.
But the flip side is it still looks good.
It does.
Yeah.
I think that's the weirdest, like, good thing we could say is that this movie looks good for how old it is.
Like, the sucking the kids in the closet scene And then the wife being like thrown around her bedroom scene. I thought both of those still looked fantastic.
It did. It really did.
I'm not going to lie. I know that that bedroom was on a rotating. It was a rotating bedroom, yeah. But it was still so great to see. Yeah, I know. Because when she was literally up. The one thing that gave it away was her first initial up onto the wall. It was a little more like I'm climbing. And then the rest of it, I was like, oh, no, you figured it out, girl. You're good. Just keep rolling. Just do one of these with your arms.
Well, and it's funny because you think of that particular scene and you're like, oh, that's, you know, that's never. Most people don't attribute that type of filmmaking or effects work to more older films. People more attribute it to like, oh, that was in Inception. They did that in Inception, you know, to Christopher Nolan, or it's done CG wise. But like, take for instance, like the unique and iconic scene from Nightmare on Elm Street with Johnny Depp, which was filmed, the blood scene was filmed upside down, and it makes it look like it just pours out from the bed into the ceiling and everything because it was filmed that way. And in this particular way as well, for this scene, the whole set was on a rotating, you know, spindle, and the director was strapped to a chair while they were filming it. So that's how they got that unique, you know, ability of it. But it's like, these effects have been done for a long time now. It's just people don't stop and think to, you know, see like, you know, where did it originate from? Oh, you know, you got, what's his name? What's the guy who played Robin in the Batman Rises movie? Joseph Gordon-Levitt, like, yeah. You got Joseph Gordon-Levitt and all them like running around on the ceiling or whatever in Inception, but no one thinks about it in the other way. One of the other, what?
Well, and I literally had to double check because I couldn't remember the name of it, but that effect was done also in Fred Astaire Dancing on the Ceiling in the 50s with the Royal Wedding. So that, and then apparently Stanley Kubrick. Stanley, he did it also in Space Odyssey,
2001, yeah. A Space Odyssey.
But yeah, that's the first time I remember being like, there's somebody doing stuff on the ceiling. This is weird.
Yeah. I do have to say, like, one of my most favorite effects in this particular film was the effects of the actual like entity coming out of the room. And the entity that was guarding the room, like the physical manifestation, like when Craig T. Nelson's holding onto the rope and the thing just lunges out of the doorway right at him. That is such a good effect. And it is so unique for that time that I remember the first time I saw it, it genuinely scared me. And mind you, rightly so, because I was only 4 or 5. But still, like seeing it come out of the doorway and right at him, it felt so like tangible. Yeah, see, just like that. We got Poltergeist here in the studio.
No, thank you.
And it's going to follow Amy home.
No, it is not following me anywhere.
And it's going to lay next to you in the bed.
Please don't encourage those types of things to happen.
But, and then even the one that you see that is right in front of the door that looks like a giant, like, skeletal demon dog, that was cool, too. Like, the puppetry work in that.
Yeah, the puppetry work and the texturing from the etherealness, which was, like, gauze and something else, gave such a great float to it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It kind of reminded me a little bit, not so much in a scary, well, maybe still in a scary way, Muppet Christmas Carol's The Ghost of Christmas Past.
Mm. But that puppet was in the water to get that. But I don't think that was a big puppet.
Well, again,
I mean, not the Christmas Carol one, but this one that was like the giant dog slash
it. Thing. You don't know how the compositing was done for it. So it could have been in one plate and then they put it over that one, but it filmed it small. So either way, I really do appreciate like those types of effects in the film and whatnot, and how it panned out. So wrapping this thing up, I definitely want to ask you guys. So I did want to do a special segment since this is a unique and spooky time of year. Mm-mm. I wanted to ask your guys' thoughts.
No.
On some conspiracy theories about the film. And Spencer's shaking his head, but I want them theories. So, obviously, we've mentioned that there are a lot of... this song's going long.
I'm just like booking out the song over here, just waiting for him to try to figure out where to fade it out.
So, this movie has had, obviously, a lot of rumors and a lot of curses and... everything that everybody's mentioned thus far. So what I want to know from you guys is, what would you say, without seeing obviously the second film, obviously knowing sadly that Heather O'Rourke passed away, but not including that, what would you say if they could have done a second film, like if you were back in the 80s and you guys were a part of the team that was going to make the second one, what rumor or what curse from the first film would you guys have carried over to help make the second one?
What on earth are you talking about? What curse?
No, so they believe because of everything that went on, and there's people that died in the first one and in the second one.
I don't mean the actual ones. I mean, like, if you could make one up.
I don't want to. I don't bring that juju to any type of performance. Like, and if I was a part of that creative team, I would have started investing in Apple. Spencer, you know what I mean?
He's out here like, well, let's play the stock market.
So okay. What?
No, really getting in the spirit of the 80s.
I am.
Okay, here's a question then. Here's another question.
Okay. No bad juju.
Okay. So based on this film,
yes.
What would you say you could use, or what would you say is a good conspiracy theory that you could pull from this film? I'm trying to spin some type of positivity here.
You're asking for conspiracy theories instead of like conspiracy usually means something kind of bad, doesn't it? Like it's something they're keeping something from us.
Okay.
Versus lore or like myth that you want to perpetuate.
Here we go. Okay, this is it. Okay. The Freelings neighbors were the Don or whatever his name,
Ben.
So we get to see them once in the film as the couple. We see the dad quite often. What would you say is the conspiracy theory as to why Ben and the Freelings dad don't get along?
Because they're trying to change each other's television and they're tired of each other.
And won't you be my neighbor?
You can't interrupt a man's football game with
with his friends.
Yeah, very important. Who are, you know, just rushing to get beer and on the phone for some reason at someone else's house.
Because they had bet. So, the guy was like, I bet my life savings on this game and you can't even keep it on the TV.
So
he was screaming it.
So some people have theorized that there's a possibility that Ben might be otherworldly because of the fact, or even probably not even real. Maybe even a ghost existing in the house, mainly because so he does step off the property, but he doesn't step into their house, which is where someone else's haunting or poltergeist stuff is happening. Number one, number two, he's not affected by mosquitoes. He said so himself.
His
children have never been bitten. And he doesn't know a single person in his family who's ever been bugged by mosquitoes. And then lastly, he watches Mr. Rogers.
So. His children watch.
You know he's sitting there watching it too.
It's
he's
Mr.
Like,
Rogers. What does that make him? How does that make him a spectral entity?
It's the '80s. He should be watching football.
Unless he's distracting his children.
There we go.
Why is it that like, you're not watching football? Something's wrong with you.
He likes trains. I don't know.
It's the '80s.
Yeah.
That's all I have to say. You know I'm right. You're looking at me weird.
This is a ridiculous assertion.
So do you guys feel there's any weight to the fact that he is possibly something other than just the neighbor?
No, because there's logical explanations for literally all of that. One, did you not see their house at the end of the movie? I wouldn't step in that house either. That house looked like it was going to explode. It imploded, but like I still think like him not wanting to go in there being like, nah, I'm good, fam. Like, yeah, I get that.
And yeah, go ahead.
Sorry. And then also mosquitoes. We know that like through like in real life that some people are genetically were like,
no, they're not. There is nobody like that. That is horse manure. That is not true at all.
I'm not looking
up on that jet plane of a laptop over there. There is nobody out there. Your laptop that will rise by itself. Talking about coming from the ground and rising from the dead. This bad boy will lift off in 2 seconds. There is nobody out there who is immune.
I did not say immune. I'm very purposely not saying immune. I'm saying mosquitoes are like, not you as much. But these people, I will drink all day.
But this also, the other thing that he could be...
Where are these mosquitoes from?
Alaska. Haiti? They could also be eating or drinking something that is being expressed through their pores.
Expressed?
Yes, they're I couldn't say expressed. It's expressed.
If it was in Spanish, it would be espresso.
That's Italian. But it's being, you know, secreted from their pores that's driving the mosquitoes away. You know, I'm taking a very... if you eat the onions, the yellow or the yellow spotted lizards from holes ain't gonna get ya. Like, you got to drink the miracle tonic, Sam.
Oh my gosh!
With the words, I can't do them.
It would have been hilarious.
It's that mirthy and graith.
It would have been hilarious if, like, when he opened the door, he was just eating an onion.
Yeah, he was eating like onion dip or something when he was standing there.
Chili. He was eating chili. The man was eating. Where'd you get onion dip? Who eats just straight onion dip?
Some people do.
Oh, and just like those same one people that doesn't get bitten by mosquitoes ever?
It was the 80s. It was the 80s. Onion dip was much more prevalent in the 80s. Like, if you're talking about like good juju.
No, wait, sorry, what? I'm sorry.
I was about to say something, but I was like, I don't know.
People are just straight up putting it in a bowl and having it for breakfast. Like, honey, come get your oatmeal. I got the onion dip from last night.
It's okay, babe. Me and my Ruffles are good. Oh. Like, so here's the other thing that just brings into question more things of like, not that he's a spectral entity, but the fact is that there was no, first off, we don't know about the neighbor on the other side of the house. And in this one, why would Ben want to come over and help the Freelings when they haven't built a relationship on any like actual community? He's literally like, and they antagonize each other over the fence. And so when your neighbor's wife runs out in her oversized, like, her oversized jersey and a pair of underpants and is screaming, help me, instead of them being like, we're calling the cops. Like, even the wife's like, nah, sweetheart, we're not going inside that house. Please don't. So I don't know. I mean, it kind of set itself up.
You guys are turning yourselves out to be like the worst neighbors in the world. It's like,
no, we're looking at the way the story
house
staged.
Disappeared.
Spencer, you over here, Mister, I don't get bit by mosquitoes. This one over here, I eat onion dip straight out of the bowl. Both of you guys need to just
play back this tape. I did not say
play
that.
Back this tape. Oh yeah, play back that laptop and send it to Haiti.
Stop.
You need to get off my laptop.
This is the auxiliary laptop. Leave it alone. Like,
it's serviceable.
All right, I was just trying to see.
You're trying to find a silver lining to something that it seems like there was other things that were going on the set that just completely was outshadowed in not a good way by the filming and the choice of this story. And if I wanted to give it good juju, at least during the daytime, it looked like it was a balmy 72 degrees and everybody was outside in shorts.
Yeah. So I guess my suggestion for future productions of this movie would be to sage your entire set. Because if you're going to use real people's bones, you're going to need some help.
Or just don't use real people's bones.
I mean, it was the 80s. I don't know if we can tell them not to.
I think the precaution just kind of cancels out the second part of that. So it's just
but it canceled it to be neutral.
Hopefully. I mean, the loss of the other two people in the next one kind of went along with that, too, or three people.
So
there's a lot of people dying in this thing, Spence, and I didn't even realize.
Super Sage.
Wrapping this thing up, let's go ahead and go around the table, talk about whether the film passes or fails and how many monocles. Let's start with Amy.
So this film actually does pass. I, again, am not a big fan of horror, but that is okay because there is a story here, even though at points it did scare me. While I am not a fan of ghosts, just in general, I don't like clowns worse. And of course they teamed up to form that trifecta. Like, all we needed is one more. No, they were in a house. It was a house horror. So they're in the trifecta of house horror, clowns, and ghosts.
Nope, you're missing one.
I do.
You're missing one.
Talk about body horror.
No, you're missing two.
No.
So the other element that Amy's not talking about is the body horror part, which is the guy who's picking at his face and children that are in danger.
That makes it worse. So, all in all, while
he's like, let me change my score real quick.
No, because this actually does deserve a good score in relation to the movie not only being iconic, but also the story that it tries to tell with as many multiple themes as it has. I can't deny a good, well-made movie just because I'm like, listen, I don't like it, you suck. Like, I don't like your genre. So this movie is actually getting a 4.5 out of 5 monocles for me, even though I'm not going to watch it again, just being brutally honest with you guys. And the last time I saw Jo Beth Williams was when she was in Tim Allen's Jungle to Jungle as the mom.
Oh my gosh.
Hey, Spencer.
That takes me back. Yeah, this movie passes for me. It's actually like really good. Mm-hmm. Like, I really enjoyed this movie. I'm mildly concerned about how I found like more of like just life in the 80s a bit more horrific than them dealing with the ghosts at certain points.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, effects still stand up in this movie. Like, there's a lot of good things in this movie and I really liked it. So for me, it's going to be a 4 out of 5.
There you go. As for me, this film obviously passes for me. It's been a lifelong fan of this film. And it has never lost its luster. Every single second of this film, every single swell of the music, everything from the opening to the close to the credits rolling, everything about this film just really just oozes with Steven Spielberg-esque and Tobe Hooper's, you know, unique fingerprint. And I just had a blast with it, rewatching it again for the first time in a while. And as far as monocles go, this film also gets a 4.8 out of 5 for me. This movie has been a staple in my household growing up. During the Halloween holidays, during any time, this movie is iconic for this particular reason. And yeah, I mean, you can't go wrong with a great horror film like this. So yeah, there you go. So that about wraps up another hauntingly spooky episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can check us out over at thefilmlosopherspodcast.com, where we allegedly have 300 episodes, everything from
400.
Action. Over, oh.
It's over 400.
We're over 400 now?
With a questionable 300, but not, we're over 400.
We're
but
over 400.
But allegedly over 300.
There's no questions about 400.
But there's that allegedly one. Over 300 episodes from action, anime, comedy, spooky movies, everything in between. If you're looking for it, we got it. Head on over to our website at filmlosopherspodcast.com. Also, you can check us out over on the socials page at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter, Instagram, and Threads at filmlosophy101. There you can catch all of our content, all of our hijinks and whatnot, as well as our extra content, such as Spencer's Big Score and Amy's Jane on Scene, which you can hear another one now in this episode, as well as other ones where?
The only place they usually live, which is at Jane on Scene on Instagram and Instagram only. But if you fail to find what you're looking for there, please just scroll back into our histories of that 400 plus episodes and find you some tidbits sans Steel Magnolias.
That is true. You can also check us out wherever podcasts are streaming, and that's iTunes, Libsyn, Player FM, Audioboom, Spotify, Pandora, TuneIn, iHeart, Amazon Music. Wherever podcasts are streaming, we are there. Tune into your heart's desire on any one of those platforms. Look for us there at The Film Lost First. Give us a 5-star review because we've earned it.
We have.
I suffered through this. Please help.
Suffered.
Clowns, right. Spencer. Clowns.
And we'd love to hear your thoughts. Drop us your favorite horror movie in the towel section down below. We'd love to hear what you are planning to watch this spooky season. And if you have any favorites, you know, let us know in the comment section. This was a great episode. And of course, we want to wish everyone out there a wonderful Halloween and a absolutely spooktacular way to end off your Halloween season and your spooktacular time. So be safe out there. Make sure to check all your candy and just have fun.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. Follow the rules of Halloween.
Follow the rules of Halloween. So says she. So.
So say we all.
Sam.
Hey, there you go. We all. Well, again, that wraps up another episode. So from all of us here, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
I'm intern Amy.
Class dismissed.